This is Impeachment, a daily podcast from WNYC. I'm Brian Lehrer. It's Tuesday, December 17th. Tomorrow, President Trump will be impeached almost certainly. Today, pro-impeachment rallies are scheduled for some 600 American cities. They'll be looking ahead to the Senate trial in January, demanding witnesses, not just a vote, a real trial befitting a democracy. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer has now become the Democrats' front man, taking the baton from House leaders Adam Schiff and Gerald Nadler and demanding witnesses.
This letter, I've sent it now to every one of my colleagues, Democrat and Republican. I hope some of my Republican colleagues will say, in all fairness, we ought to hear these people. There is not a single reason that has been given why the four witnesses we've asked for, while the documents we've asked for, should not be presented. I don't know what they'll say. Maybe they'll be exculpatory to President Trump. But to not have them is to engage in a cover-up.
Senator Schumer, it's the same clip we opened the show with yesterday from MSNBC yesterday morning. He was out saying different versions of the same thing, demanding Mulvaney and Bolton and two other witnesses through the day yesterday. Keep your eyes on Republican senators like Romney, Tillis of North Carolina, Ernst of Iowa, Collins of Maine, Gardner of Colorado, and Murkowski of Alaska. They're the potential swing voters with the power to force Mitch McConnell to have a real trial with real witnesses. But the work of the House isn't done yet either. How much the Democrats and Republicans each hold their caucuses together in tomorrow's expected impeachment vote will make a statement. Republicans from Clinton districts and Democrats from Trump ones, a much larger group, the Democrats, are in the spotlight. One big story today, profiles and courage, like Michigan freshman Democrat Alyssa Slotkin from a quite pro-Trump district declaring she will vote her conscience.
The thing that was different for me is this very, very basic idea that the President of the United States would reach out to a foreign power and ask for an investigation for personal political gain. While we may not agree, I hope you believe me when I tell you that I made this decision out of principle and out of a duty to protect and defend the Constitution. I feel that in my bones, and I will stick to that regardless of what it does to me politically, because this is bigger than politics.
You hear the House divided, right? At her town hall meeting in Michigan yesterday, Alyssa Slotkin. She will now go down in history one way or another. Max Rose of Staten Island will vote yes, if you didn't know. Anthony Brindisi of the Syracuse area is another one who is considered a possible defection for political survival. Brindisi, too, now says he will vote for impeachment. The opposite of Slotkin and Brindisi could be New Jersey's Jeff Van Drew. He announced he would oppose impeachment when his district didn't seem to be for it. And now he's switching parties to the GOP. Did you hear that? Because his Democratic base probably would throw him out in a primary in the Atlantic City area. So who are you really, Jeff Van Drew? Is there a person underneath your weather vane? One other development. Washington Post article. More than 700 scholars pen letter urging House to impeach Trump. It says a group of more than 700 historians, legal scholars, and others published an open letter yesterday urging the House of Representatives to impeach President Trump, denouncing his conduct as, quote, a clear and present danger to the Constitution. Let's talk about the Constitution. With me now, Elizabeth Wydra, president of the Constitutional Accountability Center. Among other things, she is representing Democratic members of Congress in their lawsuit claiming President Trump is violating the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. Elizabeth, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be part of this conversation.
Were you one of those 700 scholars? I don't know. And what do you think of their argument in either case?
So I wasn't. This is a group of historians, and they talk about their unique role as kind of keepers of American memory. And it was a really powerful statement. These are, you know, historians are not, fire-breathing political animals for the most part. And so, you know, this clear presentation of what the founders were thinking about when they put the impeachment remedy into the Constitution and how if President Trump's misconduct does not rise to the level of impeachment, then virtually nothing does, I think is very powerful. And I hope that both the American people and the members of the House and Senate will look at it.
They seem to be focused mostly on the second article of impeachment, the obstruction of Congress. The letter says President Trump's lawless obstruction of the House of Representatives, which is rightly seeking documents and witness testimony in pursuit of its constitutionally mandated oversight role, has demonstrated brazen contempt for representative government, unquote. What's your position as president of the Constitutional Accountability Center on that particular question?
Well, I think that the historians are right. You know, we, obviously impeachment is a very serious and severe remedy, but it's one that needs to be invoked from time to time. And, you know, I think this is the moment for President Trump when it does need to be invoked. The House has had, since, frankly, even before our Constitution was written, you know, the equivalent body to the House of Representatives has had oversight authority to check the executive, whether it's, the idea of checks and balances in our Constitution, the idea that the House is empowered with the power of impeachment to look into whether impeachable conduct has occurred. It's crucial to the working of our Constitution that the House be allowed to conduct its oversight authority, and part of doing that is calling in witnesses, subpoenaing them if necessary, getting documents, again, putting out subpoenas if necessary. And if the president obstructs that, he is really saying that he is above the law. And that goes against, you know, the most fundamental American principles of justice.
I gather the Supreme Court just made a decision to review lower court rulings involving these subpoenas. There's an article on the right-leaning news site, The Hill, today that says the Supreme Court decision to review these rulings, the subpoenas directed toward President Trump in some prosecutions, undercuts this second article of impeachment. Because if the Supreme Court is reviewing the standoff, then what we have here is an ongoing legitimate legal process, not an obstruction of Congress. What would you say back to that argument?
I think that's a creative argument. I don't think it holds any water. First of all, the subpoenas that are being challenged in the Supreme Court do not relate to the impeachment inquiry. They're related to, some of them have sort of gotten wrapped into it, but a lot of the witnesses who were prevented from testifying in the impeachment inquiry, the House just didn't go after in court. They instead used it as evidence of obstruction of Congress. So, you know, they are slightly different inquiries. But also, you know, it's not even just whether there's a process going on. We've had throughout history presidents push back from time to time, but what is truly unprecedented with President Trump is this blanket refusal to even accept the idea of House oversight on crucial matters. You know, you mentioned that I represent the plaintiffs in the foreign emolument suit, members of Congress suing President Trump. Uh-huh. And, you know, that's a perfect example of how they have basically made arguments in every single context in which they are people are trying to hold President Trump accountable, to say that that search for accountability is illegitimate. They don't want our case in court, but then as the judges brought out in the D.C. Circuit argument just last week, they also don't think that the House has legitimate oversight over whether there are emoluments clause violations. They want to avoid accountability on every single front. And so even as these court proceedings go forward, I think that it's entirely appropriate for the House to use that as an article of impeachment, to say that this attempt to hold yourself above the law, to hold yourself above constitutional accountability, is impeachable.
What's your emoluments claim? Is it that there's corruption because Trump is taking money, in effect, from people who are paying to stay at hotels because they want to influence his government? Or is it something less than that?
So I guess I would say all of the above and more. So the Constitution says that the president and other federal officials shall not receive any foreign emoluments or gifts or titles, things like that, without the consent of Congress. And this provision was put in there so, you know, if there was something, you know, like an honorary gift or something from a foreign government, or even potentially what we have with President Trump, if there was the consent of Congress, you would have the transparency of having the person lay before Congress all of the foreign benefits and profits they wish to receive. And then Congress could look at whether or not it posed the potential for corruption. And if it did, they would say, you cannot accept these foreign profits, and that's in the Constitution, so that's how it goes. But if they decided that it didn't pose a threat of corruption, then they could allow the person to accept the foreign benefit. President Trump has refused to go to Congress. He has just simply continued to brazenly accept foreign profits and payments and intends to keep doing so. And this is a really clear part of the Constitution. You know, sometimes there are, what does this mean? What does that term mean? You know, a blanket refusal to allow emoluments unless you get consent of Congress is really clear. And so that's what the members of Congress we represent are coming into court to pursue, because the American people need to have confidence that when the president is on the global stage negotiating foreign policy, that he's acting in the American people's best interest, that he's acting in the interest of our national security, and not trying to further a business deal or line his own pockets. And without going to Congress as the founders intended when they wrote the Foreign Emoluments Clause, he has robbed the American people of that confidence.
And the letter from the scholars yesterday touches on this too, even without mentioning foreign emoluments by name. Some of the signatories, by the way, listeners, of this letter include filmmaker Ken Burns, biographer Robert Caro, who wrote that biography of Robert Moses, the power broker, historian Ron Chernow, who wrote the Hamilton biography that the play is based on, John Meacham and Douglas Brinkley also. And part of their letter said, collectively, the president's offenses, including his dereliction in protecting the integrity of the 2020 election from Russian disinformation and renewed interference, aroused once again the framers' most profound fears that powerful members of government would become, in Hamilton's words, the mercenary instruments of foreign corruption, unquote. So they don't say emoluments, but there's that foreign corruption again, Elizabeth, right?
Absolutely. And the founders were incredibly afraid of foreign influence in our then fledgling American democracy. They were very concerned that at that moment that we could have foreign powers trying to subvert our democratic processes, trying to corrupt our officials. And as America has gotten more powerful, of course, those fears of foreign corruption shift, but they remain absolutely central to the checks and balances that the framers put in the Constitution. They were very afraid, for example, that someone could get into power, that someone could gain the Oval Office, and then use the leverage of American power to solicit foreign help and stay in office. And that is why they put the impeachment remedy in the Constitution instead of relying on the ballot box, which is, you know, the usual check on corrupt politicians. But they knew that sometimes if you had such incredible power, and when they created the office of the presidency, the framers were very concerned that putting this much power in one office could also lead to very substantial potential for abuse of that power. And they knew that having that much power concentrated in one position would make that person a target for foreign corruption. So while they couldn't necessarily have foreseen President Donald J. Trump, certainly this type of figure was their worst nightmare. And that's why they put the impeachment remedy in the Constitution. And I think that, you know, as the historians have said, as one of the constitutional law professors said when he testified before Congress, if this is not impeachable, then what is?
Elizabeth, Attorney General Barr has said the abuse of power is on Congress's part and the left's part for bogging Trump down in so many investigations. Just looking at your webpage, I'm seeing Trump versus Deutsche Bank stemming from the House subpoena of his bank records, your emolument suit, Trump versus Mazars USA, which is over the subpoenas for his tax records. There's the Russia investigation, of course, the Ukraine investigation, the hush money investigation, the lawsuit over stealing from his charities, which he was just in court for and paid a $2 million settlement. And I could go on. Has there been anything like this in presidential history?
You know, certainly I don't think in the modern presidency has there been this vast level of corruption that we've seen in an administration. You know, obviously, there are always investigations, particularly when you have a House and a White House of different parties. And, of course, there are politics involved in that. You know, the setup of our constitutional government was intended to harness those political instincts of the different elected branches for the good of rooting out corruption. And, you know, that's what's happening here. And yes, there are a lot of investigations, and frankly, I think there could be more, but that is just a reflection of the vast corruption of this administration. You know, I mean, you could think of, for every one investigation that comes up in the news, there are probably a dozen that just aren't as high profile. You know, you think about the fact that there are all these people in the administration who don't properly have security clearances, who are getting, you know, so there's just such a deep degree of disdain, frankly, from this administration for the normal processes of government and actual laws that are on the books. You know, I think some people think, oh, well, you know, the American people elected Trump in order to shake up government. And, okay, you know, sure, but he still needs to follow the Constitution and he still needs to follow the law. And we've seen time and time again that he has not done that.
Let's take a phone call. Mike, you're on the show. Hello.
Hi. So the one argument that Jonathan Turley, I think is the name of the constitutional lawyer.
The Republicans selected lawyer in that panel the other day in the Judiciary Committee. Uh-huh.
Yep. The one argument he made that potentially resonates, I'm curious what your guest has to say, is he was saying that, as in the Nixon case, the president does have executive privilege to say, I'm not going to release certain documents. And then if there's a disagreement between Congress and the president, the courts are the ones who are supposed to decide that. And Turley was making the argument that Congress has just stepped in and said, we're not going to let the courts decide this. We're just going to impeach him over obstruction. And so I'm just wondering if that argument holds any water, that even though the timeline would be difficult, and the timeline could potentially push this for months, getting closer and closer to the election, an election that the president is maybe going to cheat in. Are they still subverting that process, that due process that the president has to say, I'm using executive privilege, I'm not releasing these documents. If you think I should release them, go through the courts. If that doesn't work for your timeline, that's too bad. You can't subvert the process just because of that.
Yeah, and that's related to the argument in the Hill that I was citing before, that since the Supreme Court took one of these subpoena cases, even though it's not from the impeachment process per se, it argues that that's the legitimate way to do it. But what do you say to Mike in Manhattan, Elizabeth?
Yeah, I think, you know, Mike raises a good point, and the president probably would have been wise to follow more of what Mike has to say and, you know, specifically made assertions of executive privilege with respect to certain documents. But instead, what we saw was this blanket refusal. You know, if you look at the letters from President Trump's White House counsel to the House on this, you know, they don't read like a lawyerly letter objecting to certain instances where the House is trying to get privileged material. They are very partisan documents, you know, disclaiming any need for the president to cooperate with the House's investigation. And that, I think, is where he really gets himself into trouble, because it isn't just, as we saw with President Nixon, sort of assertions of specific executive privilege related to certain documents or conversations. And even there, President Nixon was still eventually required to turn over his tapes by the Supreme Court. But it's really President Trump's denial that he even needs to participate in this process. And that, I think, is where the House is justified in moving in its current timeline with the article of obstruction of Congress, because, you know, he isn't playing by the normal rules where we see presidents push back on certain House investigation inquiries using executive privilege. It's the blanket denial that he even needs to participate in the process.
And right now is this day before the presumed impeachment in the House, when 600 cities across the country today, if the reporting is true, will have demonstrations that aren't so much aimed at the House anymore, but are aimed at the salient question that will be before the Senate right away. And they don't even need 23 for that. They just need 4 or 5, I think it is, to set the rules, because they need a 51 majority, that's all, not 67 votes, to set the rules that would require the witnesses, like Mulvaney or whoever they actually call as witnesses. So that's the story of the moment. That's what people need to focus on if they're going to go step by step and not give it up as a fait accompli. You agree?
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, like you said, first there is the 51 needed to set the rules. And so, you know, if we have a very robust, fulsome trial in the Senate, which is, you know, it, within the realm of possibility, if pressure is put on Mitch McConnell and Republican senators to do so, then, you know, we could see change from senators who get pressure from their constituents. So I think you're exactly right. It's important to take account of the daily coverage and to think about the way that this unfolds. And if we treat it as unfolding just as sort of this, you know, oh, well, shoulder shrug, then we're really, you know, kind of putting that into existence. So I think that the idea of having a robust, transparent trial and the idea that the Senate trial is not a place for fact-finding is just silly. You know, you have witnesses for a reason, and the idea that you would have testimony from people who clearly have firsthand knowledge of what happened is not crazy. That's kind of what you do in trials. Yeah. So I think that is a very important first step, and then we'll take the deliberations where they go. This is a process.
Elizabeth Wydra, president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Earlier in this series, we took phone calls from listeners who proposed articles of impeachment. Now we're inviting calls from listeners who do not think Trump should be removed from office. We'll give you the phone number in a minute. But here's an unusual one, a caller who opposes this impeachment because the charges are too light.
My name's Travis. I'm calling from Colorado. I actually don't think that Trump should be impeached under these articles. I think he's done a lot worse. And I think if you remove him for these things, it shows that everything else he did is okay up to this line. I would like to see him reelected, and then I would also like to see the Democrats take over the Senate and keep the House and hold him responsible for everything that, you know, a normal person would be held responsible for.
Thanks, Travis in Colorado. If you are anyone who does not want to see Trump removed from office after being impeached by the House for any reason, call in and tell us why. Leave your voicemail at 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255 or 844-745-TALK, and maybe we'll use yours on the podcast. Impeachment, a daily podcast, is excerpted from my live daily radio show, which we also invite you to listen to. It's The Brian Lehrer Show, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, streaming live then at WNYC.org. See you tomorrow.